Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill from Monday, August 24. The story, radical, has become the political word of the summer as campaigns prepare for the crucial fall stretch ahead of the midterm elections. The word radical is being slung against candidates on both sides of the aisle. It's happening as both parties are pulled from the political center, and it's being used by Republicans against Democrats and Democrats against Republicans to make the same argument. My opponent has moved outside the mainstream. Republicans often on their heels because of negative headwinds from the economy and the war in Iran have used the term regularly as a weapon against radical Democrats. From President Trump down to congressional campaigns, the GOP is eager to shift attention to how the rise of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, and the left rank of the Democratic Party in general is radical or extreme. Democrats, for their part, have used radical as a way to describe Trump and his MAGA movement, arguing it is time to put the curb on the GOP. Radical is the current word of choice in the framing battle to set the agenda for the 2026 elections, said Toby Berkovitz, a communications professor emeritus at Boston University who has served as a political consultant. The Democrats and Republicans both use it to position their opponents as far out of touch with the current social and political norms. For framing to succeed, words must be used repeatedly to sink into the minds of the voter. Berkovitz added, radical certainly fits that criteria. For both Republicans and Democrats, the partisan struggle to define radical will be a very important part of the campaign cycle, said Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. The race to define the meaning of the word has been at the forefront of political battles around the country. In Florida, GOP Representative Byron Donalds, who is campaigning for governor, has been using the word in a political ad against his opponent, Democrat David Jolly, who used to be a Republican House member. How radical is David Jolly on the trans agenda? The 32nd spot begins. It continues by saying that Jolly is radically liberal, radically wrong. The only way you defeat crazy is to stand up to it, Donald says in the conclusion of the ad. The use of radical extended to the back and forth between the White House and Senator John Ossoff, Democrat of Georgia, who is up for re-election in November, after Ossoff slammed Trump for not prioritizing his job as president. He golfs and trades stocks, he wants to build a ballroom, and travel with Natalie on their apparent defenseless flying palace gifted by the Emir of Qatar, Ossoff said at a rally last weekend, referencing White House aide Natalie Harp and beginning a days-long feud with the White House. White House Communications Director Stephen Chung responded by slamming Ossoff for being a radical extremist Democrat. Trump has time and again referred to Democrats as radical or the radical left, but he refrained from using the rhetoric when he was asked about Ossoff by a reporter in the Oval Office. The president simply called him Pee-wee Herman after the comic personality played by the late actor Paul Rubens. Democrats, from individual campaigns to Emily's List, the Democratic PAC that helps elect women, have also made radical part of their regular vernacular. Earlier this month, for example, the Democratic Governors Association released an ad highlighting Representative Tom Tiffany's, Republican of Wisconsin, radical agenda. Tiffany is facing off against David Crowley in the closely watched Wisconsin gubernatorial race. Pandering politician Tom Tiffany pretends he's anything but a congressman with a MAGA agenda, a narrator says. The truth, Tiffany's agenda is so radical that even Republicans say he's part of a group of legislative terrorists in Congress. In Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker, up for re-election, has been knocking his opponent Darren Bailey for being too radical. In a new ad called Too Extreme, Pritzker targets his opponent's views opposing abortion, including in cases of rape and incest, as well as his loyalty to Trump and his radical pro-gun rhetoric. Political observers say the word perfectly describes the polarization of the moment. It means more now than it ever did before, said Susan Del Percio, the veteran Republican strategist. It's actually more reflective of where both parties are now. But Del Percio, who does not support Trump, said using the word in broad sweeping way is ineffective. It's laughable in some cases because someone like David Jolly is anything but radical, she said. He's a former Republican and is much more independent-minded. You can't take the DSA movement and their ideas and impose that on David Jolly. She suggested it's much more effective for Republican Mike Rogers to use the label on someone like Abdul El-Sayed in the Michigan Senate race. His policies are associated with radical ideas, she said. But Republican strategist Brian Sychik, he said the word resonates with voters because it transforms Democratic policy disagreements into a warning about the people proposing it. It makes Democrats not just wrong but willing to remake the world with their policies that are not mainstream, that do not resonate with the American people, Sychik said. We are not a socialist country. We are not Europe, despite the socialist agenda that is taking over the Democratic Party. Still, Sychik cautioned, you can't just point and say radical. You have to have some meat on the bones, and thankfully Democrats are giving us plenty of opportunities to do that. Michael Eric Dyson, the renowned historian and author, called the rhetoric the Red Scare 2.0, particularly for Republicans, and even for some moderate Democrats who have seen the rise of candidates like Zohran Mamdani in New York, El-Sayed in Michigan, and Angie Nixon in Florida. As the races heat up, he and others predicted, the rhetoric will only ramp up. It's definitely a scare tactic, Dyson said. When you ain't got much to say, you got to do that. You got to play the card you got, and it's a joker. The story, Iowa Senate candidates zero in on cancer crisis as key race tightens. Candidates for Iowa's open Senate seat are zeroing in on the state's high rate of cancer diagnoses as the race emerges as one of the most unexpectedly competitive contests this cycle. The race features Democratic state legislator Josh Turek challenging Republican Representative Ashley Hinson, Iowa, for the seat held by retiring Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, Republican. The Cook Political Report, a nonpartisan election analyst, last week moved the state Senate's contest from lean Republican to toss-up. Turek, a two-time Paralympic gold medalist in basketball, is emphasizing his bipartisan record, trying to pitch himself as an independent voice. His latest ad notes that he has voted with Republicans in the State House 700 times. Hinson, a former broadcast journalist, is leaning on her record leading bipartisan bills and overseeing appropriations in the House. She also carries an endorsement from President Trump. But an X factor is each candidate's approach to Iowa's cancer rates, which are some of the worst in the country. Iowa has the second highest incidence rate for cancer in the nation, behind only Kentucky, and that rate is rising while most of the country's incidence rates are stable or decreasing. Kerry Johansson, the senior director of policy and programs at the Iowa Environmental Council, or IEC, said knowing many people with cancer was common around the state when she and her team started researching the crisis last summer. We all knew a lot of people, of course, who had cancer, Johansson said, but I think that there was an idea that it was kind of just normal. The biggest culprits, according to IEC's research, are environmental contaminants, especially PFAS, nitrates, radon, and pesticides, the levels of which are higher in Iowa than other states. You can't ever say, like, this thing caused this cancer, but we do have what we call kind of a skyscraper of risk factors, Johansson said. And when you start to say, okay, well, maybe you have radon in your home, that's a carcinogen. On top of that, perhaps you had exposure to pesticides or nitrate in your drinking water. Each of those things, when they stack on top of each other, increases the risk of developing cancer. The prominence of pesticides and nitrates, in particular, are due to the heavily agricultural economy that makes Iowa run. Johansson said, those spreading awareness of the issue have to carefully thread a needle between discussing solutions and not demonizing the agriculture industry that is the backbone of the state. I'm a farmer's daughter, Johansson said, noting that while she understands this is a tough thing to talk about, the IEC has found that the elephant in the room when it comes to this issue is what part of our industrialized agricultural system playing in the crisis. Many people in Iowa already were feeling and suspecting this was a part of the problem, she continued. The candidates for political offices are taking the balance seriously. Turek has been talking a lot about cancer as he travels the state. He has told stories about his grandmother, who died of pancreatic cancer, his father, who was exposed to Agent Orange and had a variety of health complications, including cancer, and his sister, who was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer the day Turek launched his campaign for Senate. His messages focused on cracking down on insurance companies so patients have more access to care they can afford. I talk a lot about health care as a human right, and that if I'm able to get to the U.S. Senate, I want to fight for a public option to make sure that every single American has access to a baseline level of health care coverage, he said in an interview with Ability magazine published earlier this month. Hinson, in a statement to The Hill, said she supports efforts to address the growing cancer rate by expanding access to detection and care. I'm proud to co-lead legislation that would improve access to mammogram machines, mobile cancer screening tools, and other preventative equipment in rural areas, Hinson said. We've got way more to do. I'll keep fighting for results that help families fight cancer and save lives. Hinson also introduced a bill recently that would redirect revenue from existing taxes on tobacco into cancer research, and a spokesperson pointed to her involvement in passing the Rural Health Transformation Fund as part of last year's Republican Reconciliation Package, the One Big Beautiful Bill. The focus on cancer rates comes as the race for Senate tightens. A red stronghold for the past decade, the agricultural prairie state has taken a heavy hit from Trump's tariffs and rising fertilizer prices. At the same time, Republican candidates nationwide are bogged down by the Trump administration's low approval ratings. In announcing these seats' shift to toss-up, the Cook Political Report's Jessica Taylor wrote that the political environment is uniquely challenging for the GOP in Iowa. An Emerson College poll earlier this month found Hinson leading Turek 48% to 45% within the poll's credibility interval. 6% of respondents were undecided. The Cook report also shifted the governor's race from toss-up to lean Democrat, and the gubernatorial candidates, Democrat Rob Sand and Republican Zach Lahn, have made a central issue of addressing the cancer crisis. Sand said this week took it a step further, using headlines about a new mRNA treatment for melanoma to bash Lahn over his skepticism of mRNA vaccines. Lahn, speaking at an American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network roundtable on Tuesday, singled out water quality as a cause for colon and ovarian cancer rates rising and said addressing contaminants in Iowa's food and water supply is a major, major focus. He has also talked about his father's battle with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Timothy Hagel, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, said he's seen the cancer crisis showing up in the races all across the ballot, including the three competitive House races. In particular, Democrats are hitting Republicans over their votes to cut cancer research and funding for care in the reconciliation bill last year. I did see at least a dozen of ads, not from Turek directly, but from some of the PACs that are advertising against Hinson, that kind of were chastising her for votes that she took in Congress, and so it's sort of an indirect way to get at some of these medical issues, Hagel said. Turek has said as much on the campaign trail. Looking at the state with a legitimate health care crisis, Turek said in June, only state with growing cancer rate, closed 250 more health care clinics than we've opened, and what has she, Hinson, done? She has voted to see 110,000 Iowans lose their health care. But Hagel predicted the race will mostly turn on more conventional issues like name recognition. Turek is still trying to introduce herself to voters, Hagel said, while Hinson, as a U.S. representative, is better known. But it's the reverse in the governor's race, though, where Sand, as state auditor, cut an outsized profile and is making pains to distinguish himself from other Democrats. The hope is that, to the extent that Sand might actually win, that he'll cause other Democrats and the other competitive races to do better, which is probably one of the reasons why some people think that the Senate race is a toss-up at this point, Hagel said, but I'm just not buying it, at least not yet. The story, back-to-school season expected to worsen record measles outbreak. With kids returning to school amid the worst year of measles in more than 30 years and a record number of children report exemptions from vaccines, the likelihood that the spread of measles will worsen is all but certain, according to public health leaders. The majority of U.S. public schools will have begun their 2026-27 academic years by the end of August, and students will be returning as the country has recorded nearly 3,000 measles cases across 47 jurisdictions and 36 new outbreaks this year. The number of measles cases this year has marked the worst seen in this country in 35 years, with last year already having been one of the poorest in the recent history. Public health are anticipating the return to school to worsen the current spread of the disease. Because of the situation that we are finding ourselves in, we can definitely anticipate seeing more of what we've seen all year long. Lori Freeman, CEO of the National Association of County and City Health Officials, or NACHO, told The Hill, "There's nothing that I can think of that's going to stem the tide of what we've experienced. The only thing that's going to turn it back is by addressing people's fears about immunization vaccination and getting people vaccinated." Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, directed blame toward the Trump administration for politicizing vaccines. "The worst part about this two-year surge in measles is that it was completely avoidable," Weingarten said in a statement to The Hill. "Instead of trusting pediatricians, the science, and the data, this administration turned vaccine hesitancy into a culture war, peddled disinformation, and undermined and underfunded the CDC, which now struggles to prevent outbreaks of a disease that was nearly eradicated. This leaves schools, hospitals, and the students and patients they serve vulnerable and exposed, with educators and healthcare workers serving as first responders to waves of infections that never should have spread in the first place," she added. And as measles cases continue to rise, new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, released this week found that non-medical vaccine exemptions among kindergartners reached an all-time high during the 2025-26 school year, 4.2%. Among states reporting increases, 24 reported exemptions exceeding 5%. Kindergartner measles, mumps, and rubella, or MMR, vaccination rates last school year were found to be 92.4%, still below the 95% coverage rate considered ideal for preventing widespread outbreaks. The vaccination rate has been on a steady decline since the 2019-20 school year, the last time the country had a coverage rate of about 95%. In a briefing on staying healthy during the back-to-school season, experts with the Infectious Diseases Society of America, or IDSA, emphasized the particular importance of keeping up to date on immunizations this school year. A single unvaccinated child in a school full of unvaccinated classmates can start an outbreak that spreads to dozens of families within days. Dr. Julia Rosebush, associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Chicago, said in the briefing, experts like Freeman said tracking which students are unvaccinated can be tricky, as it can step on parental rights. She noted that school nurses often have this information and advised that they develop updated emergency operations plans for when measles transmissions occur in classrooms. Measles is one of the most virulent infectious diseases, with one infected individual capable of infecting 9 out of 10 unvaccinated people they are exposed to. Further complicating matters is the Trump administration's push to rewrite long-held vaccine policy. Earlier this month, President Trump signed an executive order calling for the MMR vaccine to be split up by disease, which would in effect separate 2 vaccine appointments into 6. Since signing the order, one state after another has affirmed their plans to keep the pre-existing vaccine guidance, including California, New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, most recently. Following Trump's executive order is also currently unfeasible, as no manufacturers in the U.S. make monovalent vaccines individually targeting measles, mumps, or rubella. Freeman said her organization is focused on identifying likely pockets of unvaccinated communities that could harbor measles infections that spread to others. We know these susceptible pockets are geographically in neighborhoods, sometimes concentrated in social networks and religious communities, said Freeman. While organizations like IDSA are supporting vaccination efforts, Freeman said NACO is taking a different approach. Because of how fraught the conversation around vaccinations has become, Freeman's group is focusing on listening and educational sessions as a starting point, targeting communities and partnering with trusted leaders to open up discussions about immunization. We cannot continue to kind of force vaccinations down the throats of people who are hesitant. We have to start in a different place, and that place is really is listening and hearing and understanding what their questions are first, she said. The story, Trump's economic D-Day on Iran, puts China in the crosshairs. President Trump's announcements of a major economic warfare campaign against Iran also has the effect of putting China in the crosshairs, the Islamic Republic's largest trading partner and primary purchaser of its oil exports. Trump's threats to go after any country, business or banking institution supporting Iran come as diplomatic efforts have unraveled. 6 months of military pressure have failed to cow the Islamic Republic, and transit through the Strait of Hormuz remains a dangerous gamble. While Trump held back from calling out China specifically in a Truth Social post on Wednesday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was blunt, calling for the Chinese to get with the program. We are confident that everyone wants the strait reopened and for energy prices to come back down. Keep in mind that the Chinese get 50%, 5-0, of their energy from inside, from this Gulf, so it would do them a big service to get with the program, he said Thursday in an interview with CNBC. Bessent said he would hold a press conference Monday to detail the administration's game plan. China has rejected the U.S. threats. Sanctions and pressure tactics are not the solution. China calls on parties to act responsibly and stick to the political and diplomatic approach, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Lin Jian said when asked by Bloomberg about the impact on China. Analysts are cautious on whether Trump's threats of economic D-Day against Iran and its enablers will bear fruit, and whether the president is determined to follow through with punishing economic actions against China ahead of a state visit for President Xi Jinping on September 24. Trump is eager for China to follow through on buying American agriculture, Boeing jets, and U.S. oil, as well as preserve American access to Beijing's supply of critical minerals, essentially components of U.S. weapons production that have been depleted by the war. A much larger move against China 1 month before a leader-level summit in Washington would carry real diplomatic risk, invite a Chinese counter-response, and potentially put the meeting itself under pressure, said Craig Singleton, senior fellow at the Nonpartisan Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Trump imposed earlier sanctions against so-called Chinese teapot refineries, small to medium independent plants processing Iranian oil, as part of the economic pressure campaign against Tehran, but Beijing rejected those sanctions and told blacklisted refineries to ignore the U.S. penalties. If the administration is unwilling to target the larger Chinese entities and financial channels sustaining Iranian trade, it is hard to see sanctions alone bringing Tehran to its knees, Singleton continued. He pointed to Russia as an example. While broad international sanctions have imposed economic hardship, Moscow has demonstrated resilience by relying heavily on countries like China, holding back sanctions to avoid economic collapse. Economic D-Day sounds like dramatic, but it may say more about shrinking options than expanding leverage, Singleton said. The military campaign has produced diminishing returns, so Trump is pivoting from missiles to markets. The harder question is whether Washington is actually willing to impose costs on major Chinese actors and risk disrupting the trade truce before the summit. Likewise, Jason Brodsky, political director at United Against Nuclear Iran, said the administration's sanctions are a very strong warning to China and its banks enabling Iran, but the proof will be in the follow-through and enforcement. And Josh Lipsky, vice president and chair in international economics at the Atlantic Council, told Bloomberg News that Trump's threats against Iran are likely to fall flat absent close coordination with Europe and Chinese banks willing to cut off Tehran. He also raised both Trump's and Xi's desires for a good visit in September. It's unclear to me how we're going to choke off Iran more than we have financially without triggering immense blowback from China on the eve of President Xi's visit to Washington, which has been so carefully choreographed over many months now, he said. The last face-to-face between Trump and Xi occurred in May in Beijing. The summit was regarded as successful in maintaining relationship stability and avoiding major ruptures. The leaders discussed the U.S. war against Iran, and Trump told reporters at the time that Xi said he feels strongly that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon, one of the administration's stated priorities for starting the war on February 28, and he wants them to open up the strait. The six-month war in the Middle East is a burden on China. In June, Iranian oil imports to China hit a historic low, dropping to below 800,000 barrels per day, Reuters reported, citing data from ship tracking company Vortexa. Oil is only one part of the trade relationship between Iran and China, with Tehran relying on Chinese technology exports being critical to its building its drone and missile programs. The U.S. bars the sale of such components to Iran. The U.S. has blacklisted 366 entities based in China and Hong Kong for evading sanctions on Iran, the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission wrote in a March fact sheet. The fact sheet also noted a network of front companies and small regional banks in China and Hong Kong helps Iran launder most of the renminbi, Chinese currency, proceeds from the oil sales into the global financial system. But the disruption in global energy supplies, rising inflation, and knock-on effects to supply chain networks impact China's push to see the U.S.-Iran war resolved. China has powerful incentives to see the conflict end as quickly as possible, wrote Zhao Long, director and senior fellow at the Shanghai Institutes for International Studies, in an article for the Brookings Institution. But while China helped push Iran to a ceasefire with the U.S. in April, there are few signals that Beijing wants to intervene again. When a conflict involves major military powers and China is not the cause of the war or a party to it, Beijing generally sees neither a particular responsibility nor a realistic possibility of becoming the primary mediator, Zhao wrote. The story, Barrasso, Monday will be D-Day for the economy in Iran. Senate Majority Whip John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, said that Monday will be D-Day for the economy in Iran as the Trump administration and U.S. military vow to exert maximum financial and militaristic pressure on Tehran to end the war overseas. Their economy is in shambles, and they're still dangerous, so the president's right to focus on it, and now he's going even further economically. And as you said, tomorrow is D-Day for the economy in Iran, Barrasso told guest host Jason Chavez during a Sunday appearance on Fox News' Sunday Morning Futures. The Wyoming senator said he believes the new pressure will cause the Iranian regime to fold, opening the Strait of Hormuz and agreeing to not having a nuclear weapon. Iran's decision to effectively close the Strait of Hormuz to commercial traffic ruptured the constant flow of oil from the Middle East through a waterway responsible for carrying a fifth of the world's oil transports daily. The Trump administration's primary component for an economic D-Day includes the aggressive use of secondary sanctions, meaning the U.S. will severely penalize any foreign nation, bank, or business that acts as an economic lifeline to Iran. Meanwhile, the Treasury Department has significantly ramped up enforcement on digital exchanges, freezing an estimated $500 billion in Iranian-linked cryptocurrency assets. The U.S. Navy is also hunting down unregistered tankers and oil smuggling networks to drive Iranian crude exports to absolute zero, while federal enforcement cracks down on alternative banking mechanisms, including currency swap lines, cash transfers, and underground exchange houses, as reported by CBS. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessin is scheduled to reveal the exact detailed mechanics of the expanded Operation Economic Fury plan during a press conference on Monday. On Sunday, Bessin said the impact of Economic D-Day would be forceful. We are now entering the endgame. As at dawn begins an economic D-Day, the single greatest financial offensive ever marshaled against an adversary, the Islamic Republic has subsisted by dressing extortion as security guarantees, the Treasury Secretary wrote in a post on X. It has drawn strength from a calculus that regards Iranian retaliation as certain and American enforcement as negotiable. Under President Trump, that era is over, and those who fear the danger of defying Tehran ought not to discount the cost of testing Washington, he added. Despite efforts to ramp up punishment on Iran, their leaders say it's a self-defeating mechanism that will only cause U.S. national debt to increase as the war drags on. The so-called economic D-Day is a diversion from America's own crisis, unprecedented debt and surging interest costs, Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister of Iran, wrote on social media Thursday. Doubling down on failed policies will only bring further defeat and enmity of Iranians, he added. The story, Bernie Moreno says Natalie Harp discourse has been super misogynistic. Senator Bernie Moreno, Republican of Ohio, on Sunday said discussions regarding White House aide Natalie Harp in recent days have been super misogynistic. Democrats and former White House staffers have said Harper's relationship with President Trump has been inappropriate, citing reporting from the Daily Beast that unveiled her letters to Trump in which she professes her allegiance to him. "You are all that matters to me," Harp wrote to Trump in one letter. "I don't want to ever let you down." In a separate letter, she wrote, "And please, when I fail, will you tell me? You have the absolute right to cuss me out, if need be, when I deserve it, because no one knows or cares about me more." In response to comments alleging an inappropriate relationship between Harp and the president, Moreno told reporters, "That's super misogynistic. I mean, the reality is she's a very talented person. She's very smart at what she does. She helps the president make sure he's communicating. And the fact that if it was a guy, nobody would say that," he added. Moreno said the rumors are arising just because Harp is a woman and obviously pretty, when the reality is she's very talented. She's very, very smart. I happen to know her very well. It's also obviously a very kind person. She went through bone cancer in her 20s, Moreno said. I mean, look at the other day. I've always said, let's just keep personal issues out, he added. Harp is affectionately referred to as the human printer in the White House and remains at Trump's side on Air Force One flights and high-level meetings to provide news clippings and comments for the president on demand. She campaigned for him in 2024 after she credited Trump for saving her life by signing the Right to Try Act, which gave her access to medical treatments that cured her of cancer. Following the campaign trail, Harp transitioned from a television host on One America News Network to a key White House West Wing aide and executive assistant to the president. Senator John Ossoff, Democrat of Georgia, recently said Trump doesn't want to do the job, but rather focus on the White House ballroom project and travel with Natalie on their apparently defenseless flying palace gifted by the Emir of Qatar. Ossoff made the comments during a campaign rally 2 weeks ago, referring to the new Air Force One jet, causing pushback from the White House. Eric Trump also stepped in to defend Harp, writing, "Natalie is an incredible young woman, a cancer survivor, and a genuinely good person, and arguably one of the hardest working people in the White House. She's deeply committed to my father, to her job, and to this country," in a post on the social platform X. The story: service member aboard USS Lincoln decries father's ICE detention. A sailor on board the USS Abraham Lincoln on Saturday said his father was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Joshua Aviles has spent roughly 9 months deployed at sea due to the Iran war, amid reported shortages of clean water, food, and supplies. "I've been deployed for over 9 months out at sea in the Middle East aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln, fighting for a country that has given me everything," Aviles wrote in a post on Facebook. "I just got a call that my dad was taken by ICE. If you know my dad, you know he is a hardworking, humble man who is always willing to help anyone if he can. My dad has a driver's license, social security card, and work permit," he added. Aviles said his father was waiting to get his green card approved at the time he was detained. NBC News confirmed on Sunday the detention with the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS. The Hill reached out to ICE to confirm the arrest, but did not immediately receive a response. "We are simply enforcing the laws passed by Congress. This administration does not pick and choose which laws to enforce," a DHS spokesperson told NBC, adding that work authorization or pending application do not confer legal status in the United States. "This is heartbreaking for me. I don't know how I can mentally continue working 12-plus hour days, knowing that my dad is somewhere, possibly being treated like a criminal," Aviles wrote in the Facebook post. "My dad's only crime was coming to this country to give my siblings and me a better life," he added. Aviles' comments come after Democrats reported that under President Trump, ICE has arrested 125 veterans and attempted to deport at least 282 veterans and family members. Aside from legal concerns, DOD's new practices create a chilling effect on service members and their families, who may avoid accessing bases, medical care, housing offices, or support services, or leave the military entirely out of fear that routine interactions could lead to detention or deportation. Democratic lawmakers wrote in their letter obtained by The Hill and sent to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Veterans Affairs Doug Collins, and Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen. The story is the This Week on The Hill column, Georgia's South Carolina special elections draw focus. Lawmakers are fanning out across their districts and states for fundraisers, local events, and campaign stops as the midterm elections heat up, while national party leaders are increasingly wading into the races that could help shape control of Congress. In Georgia, voters are heading back to the polls Tuesday for a special election runoff to fill the vacancy left by the deaths of longtime Representative David Scott, Democrat of Georgia, who died in April at age 80. The runoff pits the late congressman's daughter, Marcy Scott, Democrat, against Everton Blair Jr., Democrat, former Gwinnett County School Board Chair. Marcy Scott garnered roughly 48% of the vote in the July primary, while Blair received about 35.6%, sending the two Democrats into Tuesday's runoff, according to Decision Desk HQ. The political spotlight will also turn to South Carolina, where Republicans are set for a closely watched Senate primary runoff between interim Senator Darlene Graham, Republican of South Carolina, and Representative Ralph Norman, Republican of South Carolina. Darlene Graham, who was appointed to fill the seat belonging to her late brother, GOP Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and is running for a full term, has been in the spotlight in recent days after she said during a debate last week that she's not that informed on national security. And on the court's front, expect President Trump's hush money conviction to be back in the spotlight, the judge mulling the president's long-running bid to move his appeal out of New York state courts has newly indicated he expects to rule by Friday. Trump wants to fight his conviction in federal court in the hopes of ultimately tossing it on presidential immunity grounds. What you can expect this week, Democratic candidates vie in Georgia's special election runoff. Marcy Scott, the late Representative David Scott's Democrat of Georgia daughter, and Everett and Blair Jr., former Gwinnett County School Board chair, will go head-to-head at Tuesday. President Trump stumps for Darlene Graham. Trump is hoping to use his influence to convince GOP primary voters to choose Senator Darlene Graham over Representative Ralph Norman in South Carolina's Senate primary runoff. Federal district judge to decide on hush money case. A federal judge will determine whether to move Trump's appeal out of the New York state courts. Georgia special election runoff puts late congressman's daughter in focus. Marcy Scott previously told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that she saw the special election to fill her late father's seat as a way to carry on his legacy. Representative David Scott, Democrat of Georgia, was first elected to Congress in 2002 and rose to prominence in 2021 when he became the first black lawmaker to serve as chair of the House Agriculture Committee. He has been hailed by members of the Congressional Black Caucus, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, who characterized Scott as a trailblazer on Capitol Hill. Georgia's 13th Congressional District, a blue stronghold that David Scott had easily defended for decades, covers portions of six counties in the Atlanta metropolitan area. The winner of the August 25 runoff will represent the seat through the end of 2026. Marcy Scott and Blair were two of three Democrats on the ballot in July, alongside former Judge Carlos Moore. Two Republicans also ran for the seat, Cesar Gonzalez and Faith Park. A fourth Democrat, Tony Brown, appeared on the ballot but had been disqualified. Marcy Scott has been endorsed by Democratic Representatives Nkema Williams of Georgia and Maxine Waters of California, while Blair has been endorsed by Representative Lucy McBath, Democrat of Georgia. Both candidates have centered their campaigns around affordability, a key issue in the midterms, amid rising grocery prices, gas costs, and inflation. Blair wrote on social media that he launched his campaign because he believes in building a district where housing is affordable, health care is accessible, schools are fully funded, and families aren't stretched thin just trying to get by. Marcy Scott, meanwhile, has championed infrastructure investment, protection and veterans programs, and benefit and workforce development. Graham Norman go head-to-head in South Carolina runoff. Trump-backed Darlene Graham is set to face off against Norman, who has been endorsed by Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina, and former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, Republican in the Senate primary runoff Tuesday. Questions about whether Darlene Graham is experienced enough to serve in the Senate roared to life after she flubbed a national security question. Norman told Kelly Meyer of News Nation that Darlene Graham's debate response was serious, but Darlene Graham later told Fox News that I have said many times I'm not a politician, certainly not a career politician, I don't speak politician. Trump stumped for Darlene Graham in Myrtle Beach, which is home to former Senate candidate Representative Russell Fries, Republican of South Carolina District. Fry did not advance out of the initial Republican primary election to replace Lindsey Graham, making his support base critical for both Norman and Darlene Graham. Graham has been backed by other prominent Republicans, including Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and the state's Lieutenant Governor Pamela Avett. Sanford, meanwhile, endorsed Norman last week, arguing that the stakes are simply too high as our nation really is at a financial tipping point. I have seen firsthand his experience in legislative circles, matched by a conservative voting record and conservative stance, and all of this brings me to a binary choice, not only on the bigger question of less government and more freedom, but on who do I believe holds the best shot at holding the line on government spending, our debt and its accompanying deficits. I am freaked about this issue given our crossing of the $40 trillion federal debt mark this week. It has heinous implications for all of us, the former South Carolina governor wrote on social media. Norman, a member of the House Freedom Caucus, wrote in a social media post that the Senate has become a place where good legislation goes to die, and as we elect our next U.S. senator, we need a proven conservative to take up the mantle and fight. I'm the only candidate in this race with the experience and the resume to take on the job, and I look forward to representing the Palmetto State in the United States Senate, he added. Trump hush money case in the spotlight again. U.S. District Judge Alvin Hellerstein indicated last week that he expects to issue a decision on whether to move Trump's appeal in his hush money case out of the New York State courts. Trump wants to move the case so he can try to convince a federal judge that the Supreme Court's presidential immunity ruling compels tossing the jury's 34-count guilty verdict. Trump was convicted of falsifying business records in connection with a hush money scheme to keep quiet his alleged affair with porn actor Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 presidential election. Trump has long argued he cannot get a fair shake in New York State court system and has repeatedly attacked the judge and jury that decided the case. A three-judge panel on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled November last year that it cannot be confident a lower judge adequately considered Trump's arguments as he sought to move the case. The court bypassed what we consider to be important issues bearing on the ultimate issue of good cause, the panel wrote. The panel emphasized it has no view on whether Trump's strategy should ultimately succeed, only that the lower judge needs to reconsider his prior ruling. We leave it to the able and experienced district judge to decide whether to solicit further briefing from the parties or hold a hearing to help it resolve these issues, the panel wrote then. The story, Sullivan endorses Sullivan against Sullivan in Alaska. Three Dan Sullivans are weighing in on Alaska's Senate race, but only one Dan Sullivan has earned the support of a former lawmaker with his namesake. Senator Dan S. Sullivan, Republican of Alaska, was endorsed by former Anchorage Mayor Dan A. Sullivan, Republican, last Tuesday as he prepares to face off against Dan J. Sullivan and Representative Mary Peltola, Democrat of Alaska, in November. As the OG Dan Sullivan, I urge Alaskans to vote for Senator Dan S. Sullivan. He's been great for Alaska, the former mayor of Anchorage, wrote in a Facebook post last week. The post comes after Dan J. Sullivan's campaign faced legal challenges as Dan S. Sullivan and the National Republican Senatorial Committee accused him of launching a Senate bid to create confusion for voters seeking to elect the incumbent lawmaker. Carol Beecher, a registered Republican and the director of the Alaska Division of Elections, attempted to remove Dan J. Sullivan from the primary ballot and disqualify his campaign, citing his logo's similarities to the incumbent senators. However, Dan J. Sullivan challenged the measure in court, and in June, Superior Court Judge Thomas Matthews ruled that Dan J. Sullivan could remain on the ballot for the state's primary on August 18. Republicans Dan J. Sullivan and Dan S. Sullivan advanced to the Alaska's general nonpartisan election in November, alongside Democrat Peltola of Alaska, who Dan J. Sullivan has said he voted for twice in previous elections. The race is considered a toss-up by the nonpartisan Cook Political Report, while Decision Desk HQ has Peltola favored to win due to her past success in statewide races and status as a moderate Democrat who hires Republican staffers on the Hill. Some Republicans have accused Dan J. Sullivan of being a Democratic plant and entering the race to siphon votes away from the incumbent senator with the same name. Dan J. Sullivan, a retired teacher, has denied those accusations. The story, Oz, MMR vaccine is not a lethal vaccine. Dr. Mehmet Oz, the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, noted Sunday that the measles, mumps, and rubella, or MMR vaccine, is not lethal, contradicting President Trump. The MMR vaccine is not a lethal vaccine, and it is offered in other countries, Oz told host Margaret Brennan on CBS News' Face the Nation. After signing an executive order to alter federal guidance on the childhood vaccination schedule, Trump claimed the MMR vaccine was lethal in some cases. The president's order recommended that physicians split up the combined MMR shot, which has been available since 1971. Doctors recommend that children receive the vaccine at 12 to 15 months and again at 4 to 6 years. Together, there could be a possibility they are quite lethal, the president said in the Oval Office, referring to the MMR vaccine. And separately, it looks like they are not at all lethal, but are just very effective. In addition to splitting up the MMR shot, Trump's order recommends that all children receive just 11 core vaccinations. Children at the higher risk of infection should receive more vaccines, while others can still access vaccines after consulting with a doctor. Oz said Sunday the order, which multiple medical experts have criticized, is intended to ensure Americans have a choice in deciding whether to vaccinate their children. The request of the president is to make sure that states offer parents either eligibility because of religious beliefs or other reasons why they may not want to have their kids take all the vaccines in order, the CMS administrator told Brennan. The story, Pence stopping ballistic attacks in Ukraine, will take the last fighting tool out of Vladimir Putin's hands. Former Vice President Mike Pence and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday stressed the importance of Ukraine having the capabilities to deter Russian ballistic missile strikes. During an interview with News Nation's The Hill Sunday, Pence said Russian forces have shifted to using high-arc ballistic missiles and cruise missiles to strike Ukraine. Those weapons require Patriot interceptors or terminal high-altitude area defense, or THAAD interceptors, the former vice president noted. Pence on Sunday addressed a national prayer breakfast in Ukraine and spoke with Zelensky. And President Zelensky again reiterated to me what he said publicly, that he's anxious to see the United States make up to 5% of our Patriot resources available to make it possible for Ukraine to beat back those ballistic missile attacks, Pence told host Chris Steigerwald. Stopping those ballistic missile attacks essentially will in many ways take the last fighting tool out of Vladimir Putin's hands, he said, referring to the Russian president. While President Trump granted Ukraine a license to co-produce Patriot missiles in July, analysts have emphasized it will take years before the Eastern European country is able to produce a suitable amount of those weapons. Also complicating matters is the fact that the U.S. has exhausted nearly 80% of its THAAD interceptors and roughly half of its Patriots during the Iran war, CNN reported earlier this month. Pence, though, denied Sunday that the Pentagon depleted its interceptor stockpiles is hurting Ukraine. I don't see it that way, and I don't think the Ukrainians do either, Pence told host Dana Bash on CNN's State of the Union. July marked the deadliest month for civilians in Ukraine since May 2022, according to the United Nations Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine. Zelensky said Sunday he briefed Senators Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, and James Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma, in Kyiv on Russia's ongoing ballistic missile terror. The Ukrainian leader wrote on social media, "It is very important for Ukraine to have the capabilities to counter this, and implementing the decision to grant licenses for the production of Patriots could significantly help." Pence echoed Zelensky's rhetoric, saying it is essential for the Trump administration and other foreign allies to continue backing Ukraine militarily. Without further assistance, an unprotected Ukraine will be at risk of Russian attacks on energy infrastructure sites. As winter approaches, the former vice president stated, President Zelensky made it clear to me that Putin is going to use those ballistic missiles to strike, particularly not just like he did at a children's hospital this week, and not just as he did at a shopping mall this week, Prince told Steyerwald, but he'll use that to take out the energy infrastructure here as winter approaches. The story questions arise as U.S. claims deeper control of Strait of Hormuz. How much oil is actually getting through the Strait of Hormuz? And is the reward for the Pentagon worth the resources it is expending? Those are some of the key outstanding questions as Trump administration touts some success in steering tankers through a southern channel of the strait along the coast of Oman. The operation has allowed the U.S. to claw back some control from Iran over the passage, which has been largely closed since late February, but these efforts require significant resources from the Pentagon, and the reward is just a fraction of gain in the amount of oil traversing the strait compared to pre-war levels. The administration's latest measures appear to have at least prevented global oil prices from jumping even higher, though the Brent crude price stood at $94.39 going into this week, up from where it had begun the week prior. It has not alleviated the pressures Republicans are feeling over the economy and the issue of affordability as the midterm elections in November inch closer. Petras Katinas, a research fellow in energy and defense with the Royal United Services Institute, said Friday that only three or four vessels have passed through the strait on a daily basis in the month of August, far below the numbers in February when 35 ships passed inbound and 39 outbound. U.S. officials, however, told Axios that 40 tankers traversed the waterway Friday night through the southern channel off Oman. They also said the effort had facilitated the transit of about 16 million barrels to the global energy market. Those figures would represent a major jump in ships transiting the waterway in recent weeks. Katinas sounded a skeptical tone on the figures. I know the White House claims around 15 to 20 vessels pass the Strait of Hormuz per day, yet we've learned the White House math is not very strong, he told The Hill. The United Kingdom's Navy Maritime Trade Operations Center also put out a lower estimate, stating that since August 7, very few vessels have openly transited the strait. The costs of getting more ships out are expensive, and there are the risks to operation, most notably that it could draw fire from Iran. There is a challenge to the extent that this kind of covert shipping of oil is going on, the extent to which it starts to become more significant, therefore less easy to hide, and perhaps also therefore is more open provocation to Iran, said Mona Yacoubian, the director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She suggested the bigger the Pentagon's operation gets, the more it could attract Iranian attacks. We've seen the Iranians respond to this kind of a thing already in the past, so it could be that it's in a bit of a catch-22, where as long as the amounts that are being secreted out are not massive and significant, that type of an operation may be able to continue and be done without enormous resources, Yacoubian said. She added, but it then doesn't really have much of an impact on the global markets, which is really the effort here. The U.S.-led operation has helped empty tankers enter the Gulf from the Arabian Sea through the strait, pick up oil from countries in the Middle East, then exit, according to Axios.